Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel. On the podcast today, we have Katie Stallard, who's a senior editor at The New Statesman and previously a correspondent for Sky News in China and Russia, as well as being a non-resident fellow at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., among many other things. And she'll be talking about her new book, Dancing on Bones, History and Power in China, Russia, and North Korea, which was published in 2022, just a few weeks ago, in fact, by Oxford University Press. Few states consistently occupy more column inches in Western media today than China, Russia, and North Korea, with each seeming in their own way to present a challenge to the US-led global order, if indeed you can still call it an order at this stage. Of course, no shortage of attention has been paid in recent weeks to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, but coverage of this catastrophe still competes with reporting on Beijing's shifting policies in Hong Kong and Pyongyang's latest missile launches, to name just a couple of examples. But if an atmosphere of menace or crisis seems to surround these states' relations with the West in the present day, then it's just as important that the challenge they pose is a historical as well as a contemporary one. History, of course, matters to any state, but as Katie Stallard shows in Dancing on Bones, today's Chinese, Russian, and North Korean leaderships have gone to specific lengths to shape historical narratives in order to secure their grip on power. Based on years of reporting and research from all of these places, Stallard mixes analysis of political events in each country over the past 70 years or so with first-hand accounts of her own interviews and reportage, painting a vivid picture of how in each place the past is made to serve the present, as Mao Zedong put it. Juggling multiple timeframes in three different locations is no easy task, but this accessibly written book manages this with aplomb, and in doing so sheds light on connections between these important countries which go well beyond generalized perceptions of them as revisionist powers. But the author's here to say more about all of these crucial topics. So I'll say, Katie Stallard, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to speak to you.
Well, great to read a book on probably the three countries that I'm most interested in myself too. So as a self-indulgence exercise, also very gratifying. But this obviously has nothing to do with me. So I'll start by asking you about your background, how you became interested in these places in general, and then more specifically in the relationship in each of them between history and power.
Well, so I'm originally from the far northeast of Scotland, and it probably wasn't a natural path from there to Russia and China. But my mother had studied Russian at university, and I grew up hearing stories about her own travels there back in the days of the Soviet Union, traveling through Checkpoint Charlie in a minibus and being rushed to the front of the line to see Lenin in Red Square. So I had a kind of a long-running interest in Russia, and I was very fortunate to join Sky News in London as a reporter, and really set about trying to chart a path from there to Russia. I was very keen to get the chance to live and report from Moscow, which I was very fortunate to get the role there in 2012. I spent around 3 years reporting in Russia for Sky News. I was based in Moscow, but covering the wider region, and significantly for our purposes, that included the period of the, I guess, what we're now would call the first war in Ukraine, beginning in 2014. So spent a lot of time traveling backwards and forwards between Russia and Ukraine, and then from there moved to China in the mid-2015, and spent another 3 years reporting from Beijing, where I also picked up the beat covering North Korea. So I reported pretty extensively from on North Korea over the next three years, and then ultimately got the chance to travel there and report on the ground too. So a sort of a combination of personal interest, luck, opportunity has given me the chance to live and work and report from these three, as you say, very, very consequential and countries that are always in our headlines for one reason or another.
Right. And I mean, just on that, I mean, given that they're places that are so often connected, often, you know, in a way that maybe doesn't reflect as deeply as you have on the sort of profound links between them. I just wonder, in a large media organization like Sky or any other, is there a sense that someone who's reported from Russia will be well suited to going to China as well? Does that connection exist institutionally, or was this something that was more just your own sort of preference and chance kind of thing?
I think there's certainly a sense that if you can operate in one, you can probably operate in another. So I think there's both, you know, there's the sort of nuts and bolts of reporting and journalism, and some of the factors you're dealing with in Russia are similar for China. So in terms of, you know, surveillance, security concerns, it being very difficult to conduct interviews, and you know, working within a repressive regime is you know, is something that I had experience in Russia, and so I guess made them think I could cope with it in China. But then I think also there, you know, as you know, looking at these countries, I think once you start to look at the history and understand the importance of, you know, Leninist political systems, for instance, there are links between these countries and their past that are beyond the sort of grouping that we tend to see now in terms of being at the top of threats to Western and United States security. Those links existed long before we started grouping them together as this sort of modern day axis.
Sure, yeah. No, there's an awful lot to plumb into going back, well, even beyond the already impressive scope of time that you bring into this book. But on the book then, how did the idea of writing this book kind of come out of your experiences in these places?
I mean, it was a gradual process, but I think looking back now, there were a few key moments that really led to this. So the first was right back in 2014, and it's actually what I start the book with this in the introduction, is the experience of being on the ground in Ukraine after the Maidan Revolution and traveling through southern Ukraine towards Crimea, where at the time all we knew was that these little green men, is what people were calling them, they were Russian forces, but they'd taken off their insignia, had taken control of airports and key infrastructure. And so driving was the only way to get there. And when we came close to Crimea, very late at night, we were stopped at this checkpoint, which had just gone up by you know, local guys in camouflage gear and masks with guns, who were stopping all the cars and checking them. And the reason that they gave for what was happening was grounded in the history of the Second World War, or the Great Patriotic War, as it's called in Russia. So the first thing that these guys were telling me was, you know, this is the land of our ancestors fought during the Great Patriotic War. Now fascists and Nazis are on the rise again, and we're here to show that that's not going to work and to stand against them. So right from the early days of that conflict, the war just felt like it was very present. People wore the orange and black ribbon of St. George to identify themselves on the separatist side. And it was fascinating to me to see just how consequential those historical narratives were and how they seemed to be driving. You know, you'd come to checkpoints in a rural part of eastern Ukraine, and there'd be a poster of Stalin there. Like the symbols from that past war and from the Soviet past were really present in that current conflict. And then moving to China, one of the first major assignments I did there was this Victory Day parade in September 2015 to mark the anniversary of the end of the war, which is something that happens in Russia and which looked like it was, you know, a long-held tradition in China too, but wasn't. It was the first time it had ever been held. So looking at those two incidents together, I felt like there were echoes of the same story in both countries. And I just became really fascinated in, well, how does the history of these past wars play into current day politics here? How are those in power manipulating, harnessing the story of these wars? And what is the version of history that you would learn if you grew up in these countries? And how would that make you see the world? So I think those were the two sort of key points that got me really hooked on this idea. And then once I started to also cover North Korea and I saw how history was being used there, I thought, well, if I'm serious at looking at how autocrats use history and manipulate history, North Korea is just, you know, the nth degree example of this. So I should try and look at North Korea too. So it was logistically a vast and probably totally unadvisable undertaking to try and look at all three countries, but I really felt there are gradations of the same story here, and we can learn from looking at all three rather than looking at any one on its own as a sort of exceptional example that has no compatriots.
Mm. Well, that leads very naturally on to the kind of next question, I guess, which draws us back to this comparison, this grouping of these places together, often, as we've already said, in a sort of non-analytical way, perhaps. So what is it about the continuities or similarities that makes you sort of see those as being worthy of A, comparison between them, and then B, highlighting as something specific that is different to how any state, any political community or body might, you know, use history or draw on what, you know, we might think of as a usable past, right, to use that term. How are these places different, or at least specific and similar enough to merit study together?
Yes, I think it's important to be clear right at the outset that the impulse to do this and to manipulate history in this way is by no means limited to autocrats. I think we can all think of plenty of democratically elected leaders who draw on the past in a very selective manner to serve their own political purposes. And that's because it works. I mean, these stories resonate. They rally popular support. So if you are somebody who is interested in getting or keeping power, then of course you would try to harness the power of the past. But the point I come out to in the book is that we as citizens should be very wary of that and of how these narratives are being mobilized, because first and foremost, they're being used to serve those in power and entrench existing political systems rather than to actually address the issues of the country and to serve us individually as citizens. With these three countries, what really struck me studying them in depth was the degree to which that sort of official version of history was really becoming certainly the only version of history you could voice publicly. I think, you know, when I first started the book, there was a greater degree of separation between the three in terms of the information environment. So in Russia, for instance, you know, 2015, 2016, there were still independent media outlets, albeit under growing pressure in recent years. Internet access was relatively free. You know, you could, if you were interested, find information that contradicted what you were seeing on Russian state television news. So there were differences in the degree of control that the respective regimes had, but those have become more similar over time. So they you know, access to alternative sources of news, alternative information in Russia has really been dramatically shut down over the course of the last 12 months, in particular. But I think it was really wanting to understand. So these are, you know, there are three countries that I was personally reporting about, but that were constantly in our headlines, and seem to be. We talk a lot about these countries, but I felt we weren't always doing a great job of understanding what was actually happening in these countries with any degree of nuance or detail. So I wanted to sort of take these sort of almost caricatures of strongman leaders that we see on the news and try to understand how does this work in practice? Like, how are they using, how do they use the past? What are the stories that they tell? What is the case they make for why they should be in power and why they should build up these weapons programs, why their actions are acceptable? So I wanted to sort of, I guess, with my sort of reporting hat on, you know, I felt like we were missing an important story of what is actually happening inside these countries and what role is history and specifically the role of the history of past wars playing in their contemporary politics.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, we'll jump into the specificities of, you know, some of those developments in a second. I guess one final question, though, that just, you know, slightly relates to that question about comparisons outside just these three. But I guess I'd be curious as well, while we're still in the framing stage of thinking about this, whether you came to think any differently about history as you had learned, or, I mean, I guess, you know, not to over-personalize it, we grew up on the same island, but in parts of it which maybe have their own respective different approaches to history, and indeed also lots of bits of history that don't get talked about in either place. So did you come to see Scottish or British, or I guess broadly, maybe even you know, post-war Western history in any different way as a result of studying these things?
Yeah, I remember going around a museum in Glasgow during a visit back from China. So this was probably, I know, 2017 or 2018, and being really struck by how much the history of British colonialism just wasn't there. How much it just seemed to be skipped over. I think I've become really sensitive working on the book to how all of us are looking in a very, very selective way at the past, and to particularly. So I'm now based in the United States, seeing the arguments here over, you know, which parts of the past should we remember and should we or shouldn't we look at and center the darker aspects of the past. Having spent so many years focusing on how autocrats use history, I find I want to, you know, shake people by the lapels and say, no, you know, yes, we should absolutely look at all of the difficult aspects of history. It's not in our interests to gloss over this and turn the past into this kind of halcyon, nostalgic sort of fuzzy image of a time when things were great. You know, that's what autocrats do. And those of us who have leaders we can hold accountable should demand that they don't do that, and that we do teach children a more nuanced, a more balanced, a more comprehensive picture of the past, rather than sort of centering our own heroism.
No, well, absolutely. I mean, we can maybe return to that full circle if we have time to reflect on it in the end, as far as kind of outlook, looking forward is concerned too. But I'll start then by, you know, kind of jumping into the kind of main body of the book. And the chapters are divided with these very kind of pithy titles that identify, I guess, a lot of the main key dimensions to this historical, or this mobilization of history, I should say, in each place. So, I mean, just to go through them very quickly, we have myth, victory, enemies, memory, victims, truth, lies, control, heroes, patriots, and power. And those kind of, I guess, I mean, it's amazing how deftly you move between these different locations, as I already mentioned in the introduction. But we'll start perhaps with the sort of mythological aspects of the histories that are discussed in each of these places, and maybe the most mythical of all, or as you've said, the North Korean case is a sort of nth degree study in some of these processes. So you open chapter one discussing kind of the foundation myth, I guess, of North Korea. Could you say something, you know, just specifically about the content of that, how you came to, as you came to be familiar with it, and how it's changed over time?
Yeah, I mean, this was something that I really learned by reporting on North Korea and looking at, I mean, primarily what I was covering was the weapons tests. So we would tend to focus on North Korea when they were testing a new nuclear weapon or launching a ballistic missile. And when you start to look at the speeches that Kim Jong-un, the current leader, gives and the way this is reported, it's all presented as defensive, and it's all about how, you know, the country is threatened by the hostile policy of the United States, and it needs to build up its strength and its nuclear deterrent, the treasured sword of the nuclear program, as it's called there, in order to be able to defend itself. So I wanted to look at what are they referring to, and how do they, what is the case they make to citizens about why they need these weapons? And it turns out it's really, I mean, large parts of it are entirely made up. So there's the foundation myth that I talk about in the first chapter is around Kim Il-sung, the first leader, and how he came to power. Now, there are elements of truth in the story, as there are in all good propaganda. So he genuinely was a guerrilla fighter who fought against Japanese colonial rule of the Korean Peninsula, but crucially not on the Korean Peninsula. During the 1930s, he joined a guerrilla band in Manchuria in northeast China, and he genuinely did fight, and he was a guerrilla commander. But what he didn't do was liberate the Korean Peninsula from Japanese rule, which he now that's what the regime claims he did. The story has really changed over time. So in the very early years of the founding of North Korea, when the peninsula was divided between North and South, and the Soviets, who were in control of setting up the new regime in the North, selected Kim Il-sung as their leader and set about sort of seeding a heroic backstory around him. He was in the Soviet Union at the time, so he had fought in Manchuria, but then he'd been forced across the border into the Soviet Union, and he didn't return to North Korea or the Korean Peninsula at all until after the defeat of Japan in the Second World War, and Japan had ceded control of Korea. So at the start, in the very early days, the story that was told was that Kim assisted the Soviet forces, that Kim fought bravely as a Japanese partisan, and then following the Soviet defeat of Japan, he became the leader of North Korea. But over time, and he asks there is a record of him asking one of the Soviet officers, could they please write the Korean partisans back into the liberation story? They want to be able to show that they contributed to this great victory, and the Soviets refuse. But over time, the story starts to change. So in the early days, the Soviet army's in the lead. Kim's guerrilla partisans are in the rear. Over the decades, it becomes so that you know, the Koreans are in the lead, and now the Soviet army is supporting them. And now, as the story goes, it's basically just Kim Il-sung and his Korean People's Revolutionary Army, which there's no evidence to suggest that organization ever existed, stages this triumphant return to the Korean Peninsula, vanquishes Japan, liberates the country, and the land erupts into cheers and joy at Kim Il-sung's spectacular leadership and military victory. So I guess it all comes back to this first idea that Kim Il-sung personally secured North Korea's freedom, and in fact, the entire Korean Peninsula's freedom from Japanese rule. So he's a great war hero to which people owe their freedom. But then they've tacked onto the end of this that 5 years later, what we would know as the Korean War, what they call the Fatherland Liberation War, that North Korea was attacked, they claim, by the United States and South Korea. And Kim once again was able to wage a remarkable struggle, repel the aggressors, and secure North Korea's freedom once again. So he's sort of held up as this great mythical commander who saves the country twice in a decade, brings these great empires, first Japan and then the United States, to their knees, and secures the happy life of North Korea, which, you know, let's say there are elements of truth in it, but there's probably more fiction than truth.
So yeah, this is a really interesting moment where you identify a connection that exists, you know, not only sort of isomorphically, if you like, between the processes at play in each country, but actual kinetic or historical links between different parties, different events, and this fading of the Soviet role or fading of acknowledgement of the Soviet role over time is very interesting. You also document sort of observers of this at the time, you know, during the 60s, 70s, including from Soviet Union, from Eastern Europe, noticing that the Kim cult was kind of ascendant. So those links are important. And another one, of course, is China's role in that Korean War. That's another, you know, important direct connection. So moving on into chapter two, which sort of begins with more of a focus on China and shifting kind of accounts of the victory in the anti-Japanese war in particular. I mean, often what you're telling here is a history of histories, if you like, right? How history itself has been narrated and re-narrated. So could you say something more about the sort of parallel changes in how China's war record has been remembered and told more recently over time?
Yeah, I think one of the things that was really striking to me looking at both Russia and China was how much this story has changed. I think looking at them now and the way these wars are commemorated, is easy to assume it has always been like that, that every year from 1945, this has been the case. But in both Russia and China, it took the longest time for this story to reemerge. Actually, the initial response to the war by the Communist Party was to play it down. So, I mean, the key detail, which I'm sure most listeners will be aware, is that the Communist Party wasn't in power at the time. It was the Kuomintang and Chiang Kai-shek who was the leader of China at the end of the war, and it was the KMT that did the majority of the fighting and dying in that war. The Communist Party were I think they describe themselves now as fighting on the back front line, but really they were in the Yan'an base, and you know, aside from the early part of the war, it was primarily not the communist soldiers who were fighting on the front lines of this. So when Mao Zedong first came to power in 1949, he really had very little interest in remembering and certainly in centering the experience of the what we would know as the Second World War. And Chiang Kai-shek was still alive. He was on Taiwan. He was they feared he was preparing to strike back against the mainland. So he didn't want to in any way give him credit for the victory in the war or remember too much about the experience of the war. He wanted to focus on his own revolution. And so the wartime history just isn't, I think one of the things you come to realize looking around Chinese cities is that it's not part of the memorial landscape, just isn't there in the same way that it is in many countries in the West or now in Russia. You know, there is no central war memorial in Beijing. It wasn't built. And the memorial that was built in Chongqing to the victory in the war was repurposed post 1949 and became known as the Liberation Monument and was co-opted to memorialize Mao's revolution. So the wartime history it wasn't central now then in the way that it is now, and it wasn't really until after Mao's death in 1976 and really the 1980s when this story really came to be re-examined that a more representative story of the war could be told, and that the KMT's role could be acknowledged. And with that, once you acknowledge the KMT's role, then you can talk about all of the great battles that were fought in China. You can talk about the horrors, you know, the atrocities such as the Nanjing massacre, you know, the parts of the war that were fought by the KMT and on KMT controlled territory. Once they came back into the broader story of the war in the 1980s, it became an all nation war of resistance, was how they described it. And it could be something that was much more prominent, a much more important part of the country's history once again. But that really wasn't the case for decades and decades. The wartime history was kind of set aside, and the focus was really on on Mao, his revolution, and on the Korean War.
Right. And you have some great kind of personal reflections on interviews with people documenting the kind of personal level implications of this shift in focus, right? If it was earlier a sort of class struggle or a struggle between communist and nationalist parties that was stressed, then certain people were heroes within that narrative and certain people were villains. And then later, as the narrative changes, then other people become heroes and villains or martyrs and traitors, or however it's framed. And you know, people have had their own relatives and their own kind of family connections, you know, both condemned and then rehabilitated by turns, depending on what's going on. So that's where some of that very vivid on the ground reporting kind of comes into play very effectively.
Yeah, that, if I can just interject on that, one of the most important experiences of the researching of the book for me was getting to know this woman in Shanghai whose relative whose grandfather had fought and died for the KMT and who had suffered terribly during the early years of her life, because she was told that her grandfather was a counter-revolutionary because he was the KMT, that the family, you know, she grew up being told not to talk about him. You know, she knew broadly that he had died in the war, but she wasn't allowed to say any more than that. Her family really suffered in the Cultural Revolution. But as the story of the war has changed, so has the story of her grandfather. He was formally rehabilitated in 1985 and recognized as a martyr in the war. And as the wartime history there has become more central, you know, she recounted that going to watch a memorial being unveiled to her grandfather, being put up in a 5-star hotel and feted by local officials and receiving a posthumous medal for him. So I think sometimes these stories can seem quite abstract, and that they, you know, they concern primarily the history books, but they really change real lives. And in the case of this lady Zhao Yan, meant she could now, you know, she now has a prominent picture of her grandfather posted up in her shop. She likes to talk to everybody about him, who he was, how he died, and to remember him as a hero. So she's sort of lived through these changes to the historical narrative.
It reminded me, I guess, in a different context, of some of the people I've spoken to in borderlands between China and North Korea, ethnically Korean Chinese citizens, some of whose, you know, ancestors participated in the Korean War on the Chinese side. And as such, initially, with celebration of victory in the Korean War, as along the Kim Il-sung lines, were fated as martyrs or as heroes of that war. Then during the Cultural Revolution, that experience was stigmatized because it was foreign and outside China and suddenly a problem again. And so they were stripped of those martyr statuses, if they, you know, people's relatives who'd passed away and killed in the war. And then following the end of the Cultural Revolution period, the end of the Mao era, they were then rehabilitated, if you like, as complete kind of swinging to and fro in a process which I think you document well, actually, in all these places, but which is particularly noticeable in the Soviet case, to use that as a sort of seg. So do you want to say something about the great patriotic war memory here? And it's also something that has really remarkably shifted over time. What, you know, what's happened there with Stalin's involvement, and who's responsible for the elevation of the war to its current status as a sort of religion?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that I, when I first went to Russia and watched the Victory Day celebrations, just sort of assumed this must have always been like this. You know, it's so front and center as a, you know, as a holiday in Russia. But that really wasn't the case. Stalin, so he held a first victory parade right after the war in 1945. But quite quickly, he started to move against his own wartime leaders. So the Marshal Zhukov, who led that first parade, for instance, was demoted and stripped of his position. He and Stalin wanted to move away from commemoration of the war. So having decided in 1945 on the morning of what is known as Victory Day, May 9th, that this would be a national holiday to be celebrated annually. Two years later, in December 1947, he cancels that holiday altogether. There's very little explanation. There's just a short notice in a couple of the newspapers that says May 9th is now a normal working day. There will be a holiday on New Year's Day instead. And what's going on there is that he was quite concerned that by building up these military leaders, I guess a little bit like as Mao was with Chiang Kai-shek, that they might attract too much attention, they might get too much glory and prestige in their own right. In the case of Stalin, who was wholly paranoid, he was concerned they could become a threat to his own leadership. So he hadn't fought, and if you had these great frontline commanders being celebrated as war heroes every year, perhaps they could become a threat to his own leadership. It was also, you know, it did not feel triumphant. You know, the country had been utterly devastated. There was real suffering. There was famine again. Stalin didn't want to focus on the horrors and the trauma of the war and all of the rewards that he couldn't offer. You know, people had been fighting and dying for 4 years, and now what was there? You know, they were coming back to homes and lives that were destroyed. So he wanted them to move on from the war. There's a directive from his propagandist Andrei Zhdanov, I think in 1946, saying that people should be dissuaded from, quote, taking some time off to recover from the war. The idea was that they needed to get back to work, to get back to building the cause of socialism. So the war story really starts to get downplayed, and the individual commanders are taken out of it, and Victory Day just becomes a normal working day. And it's not till 1965 and Leonid Brezhnev's time that they reinstate the Victory Day holiday. So, you know, there was some chance and some happenstance. So he takes over after the ouster of Khrushchev, and is really looking for, you know, how can we rally popular support behind the party? So it was then almost half a century from the Bolshevik Revolution. The horrors of Stalin's rule were still fresh and clear in people's minds. You know, Lenin was still a very central and prominent figure, and the historian Nina Tamarkin has written extensively about the cult of Lenin that Brezhnev then dusted off and also tried to attract support behind. But Lenin didn't really capture the popular imagination and generate real emotion in the way that the memory of the war did. So Brezhnev brought back Victory Day. He built the new the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier that many people will have seen outside the Kremlin wall, had the remains of a soldier exhumed from the site of the Battle of Moscow and interred in the new memorial of the Unknown Soldier. But I think what was most striking to me is this a ceremony that I describe in the book, where they then transported a portion of the eternal flame from the martyrs' cemetery in St. Petersburg inside an armored personnel carrier all the way to Moscow, and used that flame, so the flame that commemorated the revolutionary martyrs, to light the new eternal flame at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. And the Moscow party boss gives a speech about how the ranks of these various legions, the revolutionaries from 1917 and now the Soviet forces during the Great Patriotic War would close ranks and defend the party and its place in history. So it really felt like both a symbolic and an actual passing of the torch, and a clear decision to turn to the wartime history. Mm-hmm. And use that wartime history to generate support for the party, which it really badly needed. So he's the first leader who builds what's been described as the cult of the Great Patriotic War, introduces new systems of patriotic education, presides over the building of a huge number of monuments and memorials, and really turns back to the wartime history as a key symbol to rally the country behind.
Hmm. Well, I wonder, I mean, if we could stay there on the kind of Russia case, because you document this kind of this to-ing and fro-ing extremely, extremely well. And a bit later in the book, you discuss then the subsequent period after Brezhnev and the Gorbachev era, and the sort of glasnost in this kind of description of this dismantling of some of these kind of rigid interpretations and the desire for exploration of history. At that exact time, a certain figure who now leads Russia was growing up, and I guess was conditioned to be understanding some of these things. So Do you think his sort of the fact that Putin was growing up and being acculturated to this Brezhnev era war memory, and then experienced the Gorbachev times, I guess more chaotic, more kind of unpredictable, and less ultimately, of course, good for most people on a material level. Do you think that had some bearing on his sort of attitude and approach, maybe what he was inclined to draw on in shoring up his own power later on? That's a bit of a speculative question. Who knows what his brain is doing? But,
Well, I mean, certainly if we look at what he has said about it, and with all, you know, the caveats that clearly he's not the most reliable of narrators, but he has described himself as a pure and utterly successful product of Soviet patriotic education. So he was 12 when Victory Day was reintroduced, just starting high school, and he would have been going through his teenage years just as the commemoration of the war was reaching his height, and one would presume did receive some of this patriotic education as part of his schooling. I think there's both, you know, the wider national picture, and then as there is for many Russians, there's the personal story and the personal links he has with the war. He's talked extensively about his father's own service, how he was wounded behind enemy lines, how his older brother died during the siege of Leningrad, and how his mother very nearly also died. So he both has gone through the patriotic education system, but does have these personal links to the war. And I think the experience he had of the Glasnost and Perestroika years were very different for many people. You know, for a start, he wasn't in the Soviet Union for most of that time. He had gone abroad to and was posted in Dresden for the KGB. And I think his experience of that time, and certainly of seeing the Soviet collapse, was great. You know, humiliation, chaos, personal threat. You know, he recounts in his clearly hagiographical memoirs type interview book that came out in 2000, how, you know, protesters gathered outside the KGB building in Dresden, and he feared they were going to overrun the building. So his experience of the reform years was very bad, and he saw it as a loss of power. He talks in his own writing about experiencing, you know, the protesters at the gate and calling for support from a local Soviet barracks and being told they can't do anything without orders from Moscow, and Moscow is silent. So I think witnessing that collapse of power and resolving that would never be the case, you know, it's reasonable to assume that those have played into how he now exercises power. But he really seizes on the history of the war, but it's also difficult to see what, you know, there weren't many options. You know, when he comes to power in December 1999, you know, there was the Soviet Union had just collapsed. There was the space race, but ultimately that had been lost to the United States. Stalin's memory was difficult and complicated because it was associated with the repression and the atrocities. So, you know, the revolution was tricky because you didn't want to, as he's still careful about how he commemorates the centenary of the Bolshevik revolution, passed with barely a whisper in Russia, because he's not keen to linger on the idea of the masses taking to the streets and overthrowing a corrupt imperial elite. So there aren't a great deal of options to look at. And then, you know, so there's the victory in the war, and that's what he, you know, from the earliest days of his presidency, 2 days after his inauguration, he leads his first Victory Day event. And the war allows him to paint this picture of a Russia that he wants to live in, and that many people are receptive to hearing, that Russia is this great, ever victorious, heroic nation that secured this great victory in the last century and will be victorious again. But of course, it needs a strong leader like Vladimir Putin to take the reins. So the past really serves his purposes, but he also there weren't many good options. Yeltsin had tried and failed to find, he held a competition for to find a new national idea in the mid 1990s, and came up empty-handed. So Putin seized on the history of the war, and he has continued to seize on the history of the war and amplify that narrative over more than two decades now in power.
Yeah, it's tempting to say, I don't know if this really holds up, because probably the history or experience of any significant group of people, probably beyond 10 people, is very complicated and multi-layered. But there's something, especially in the Chinese and Russian case, which, as you say, the options are few to draw on, but that must have something to do with the fact that these are vast kind of Eurasian, continental landmasses involving countless different kinds of people, different events on different scales happening, obviously now also over a long span of time. And so finding a simple story out of any of that is immensely difficult. One thing that you mentioned there too about Putin's experiences and the kind of idea of the chaos and the weakness that was experienced, I guess, in his, young or mid early adulthood, is a sense of threat, a sense of external victimhood. And this is something you draw attention to throughout, but in particular, I guess, in relation to China, if we return there. And so I just wonder, maybe in the Chinese case or more generally, what's your sense of how these victim narratives coexist with narratives of victory? Because, they might be perceived to be sort of self-contradictory in some ways, both simultaneously weak and preyed upon, but also gloriously victorious. Like, how do you see that playing out, I guess, in China in particular, but elsewhere too?
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. I think it is contradictory. They are trying to maintain two ideas simultaneously, which is that these are great, glorious, mighty countries that can never be defeated, but also that they've suffered terribly, that they're under tremendous threat. So they're both simultaneously great, glorious, and under endless existential threat. And I think the where you see that come to a head in China is in the aftermath of the Tiananmen crackdown, when Deng Xiaoping identifies the core failing. He says the greatest mistake we've made is in our ideological education, that we didn't do a good enough job of telling people what China was like in the old days and what kind of country it was to become. They felt that they had gotten the balance wrong, that they had focused too much on the victorious story of Mao's revolution, and perhaps made that seem inevitable, and perhaps made the growth of the economy and the opportunities that were starting to come to people's real lives in China seem like that was always going to happen. And he felt like they had not done a good enough job of explaining what it was like before the Communist Party took power. So they made this really clear decision to focus on China's past victimhood and to focus on national humiliation, and particularly what they call the century of humiliation that the country had suffered before the rise of the Communist Party, which I'm sure many listeners will know, but begins with the Opium Wars of the 19th century and culminates in the Japanese invasion at the start of the Second World War, when China is portrayed as being just preyed upon, carved apart, suffering terribly at the hands of all these foreign powers. And the blame for that is placed on their weak, corrupt imperial leadership. So the moral of that story and the broader historical narrative is that China must have the Communist Party's leadership if it's to be strong, safe and prosperous. So they are trying to keep those two ideas in mind at the same time, that this is a great country with a noble, glorious history, but that it has faced devastating threats before, and that if the Communist Party ever falls from power, it could end up back there again. So I think that the slogan that they were really pushing in 2021 around the centenary of the Communist Party's founding was, without the CCP, there would be no new China. This mm-hmm. idea that if the Communist Party, the Communist Party is acting in China's interests, and that if it is ever overthrown, China will be a great peril once again.
Mm. Which again sits interestingly with the sort of rehabilitation of the Kuomintang, of the nationalists. You don't get any prizes for pointing out small inconsistencies in some of these things, because the whole point in them is that they're quite general and quite broad.
I asked a North Korean defector about it, because it seemed to me there's this totally nonsensical part in the story where Kim, how could it be? I was asking him that Kim Il-sung, you know, liberates the Korean peninsula and freedom is has come to all of the land. And then the peninsula is divided between North and South. If it was Kim who liberated the Korean peninsula, how did he allow, or you know, how did the peninsula come to be divided? And this gentleman told me, we're not taught to think like that. These stories are not to be examined and analyzed, and we're not meant to look for the contradictions. It's just to be understood. Here is the form of events, the dates these key things happened. And so while it might seem, it just logically seems improbable that one day the Korean Peninsula was liberated and free, and the next minute it was divided in two with no further battles being fought. It doesn't matter. That's the story, and that's what you're required to repeat.
Right, and you kind of conclude or towards the end of the book explore more the particular ways that record of Kim Il-sung's, and then with the bridging period of Kim Jong-il, has been explored or mobilized in another context, right? A hereditary context of Kim Jong-un now being in power, the kind of connections, even to the level of similarities in physical appearance that have been made between the current leadership in North Korea and that record. But actually, that point you made leads me to one of my last questions. Basically, you're discussing there that, you know, the particular way that ordinary people come to understand these things, and the extent to which they may or may not, you know, how much credence these ideas have as far as ordinary people are concerned. And of course, there are aspects of the stories themselves, the content of how you're taught, but also the broader climate in which these ideas are shared. So, of course, the cases are very different. Not Russia, China, North Korea, they're sociologically, they're kind of demographically, they're very different in many ways, and the pluralism that is there in different ideas, even now, even despite the similarities, is very different. But in order to understand these things, as you say, in a more textured way than is often assumed, we do have to understand the role of ordinary people, what may appeal or otherwise about some of these historical narratives, and how much support there might actually be for any of these people in power. So how do you get through that kind of complicated question about where people get their, you know, how much do people support? Does it matter? Is it more of a bottom up? Is it more of a top down process? We can't ignore ordinary people altogether, obviously. In fact, my background is in anthropology, so can't ignore them at all. They're the only people that matter, really. But anyway, how do you understand the role of sort of citizens in these processes?
Yeah, I mean, I explore this in some detail in the book, the role of individual, both citizens and historians in pushing back against these narratives. So it's important to be clear that while, you know, the state is giving its version of history and making it very difficult and very dangerous now to challenge that, that doesn't mean that everyone who hears that is automatically, you know, converted, believes the regime's version of events, and accepts that history of fact. There are, you know, many brave individuals who are pushing back and who are suffering as a consequence. And actually, the title of the book, Dancing on Bones, comes from a quote from a Russian activist who felt that the way the war was being commemorated on Putin had become this sort of triumphalist, bombastic celebration every year on May 9th. And he felt that we had lost the memory of the real people and individuals who fought. So he started this movement that he called the Immortal Regiment, where they would just march quietly holding photographs of relatives who had died in the war. And the idea was to put real people and more of a sort of somber reflection back into the commemoration of the end of the war. And the movement was massively successful. They had thousands and then hundreds of thousands of people wanting to take part. And so, of course, the authorities couldn't have this grassroots movement running out with its control. So they they co-opted it. They came up with a they called it the Immortal Regiment of Russia parallel movement, which quickly subsumed the original. And now that it's this extraordinary event that, that Putin, before the pandemic restrictions anyway, Putin marches at the front of the event, holding a picture of his own father. It has become everything the founders didn't want. And this one of the original founders, when he's talking about it, says that, you know, the authorities are dancing on bones, that, you know, we should just stop and remember the individual people who fought, but they're abusing this history and they're dancing on bones. So I wanted to try and capture the way that this history is being used, but also the resistance and the grassroots pushback to that. And in terms of whether people believe the history or not, I mean, I think one of the points I came out to in the book is that partly what makes this so effective, and you know, with the caveat that these systems are different, some portion of the population is genuinely persuaded. You know, some portion of the North Korean population genuinely does believe Kim Il-sung liberated the peninsula, staved off an extraordinary attack in the Korean War, and that they're lucky to have the Kims as leaders. But for those citizens who don't, and certainly, you know, there is reason to believe that there are a number of the population who don't agree with the Kim's rule and who do feel that, you know, there are real problems that emanate from it. The problem becomes that you can't express that publicly, that discourse, propaganda becomes a tool of power. You know, if people know what is expected of them and they can only express certain limited views in public, it's very difficult to know whether you're in the minority or not, whether a significant number of people agrees with you that this history doesn't add up and that you don't support the leadership if all you're allowed to do in public is express your undying support. So, I mean, I had the experience in North Korea of you know, speaking to people face to face, you know, in their own homes and seeing their eyes well with tears and just not, and thinking, I just have no way to know, do you genuinely believe what you're telling me right now, which is that you're grateful from the bottom of the heart, from the bottom of your heart, for the Kim's leadership and sacrifices for the country? Or do you just understand that that's the only view you can give, particularly to a foreign journalist who's accompanied by, you know, a gentleman to one side, a gentleman to the other side, who are writing down everything you're saying and know where you live and what your name is. So it's a sort of twofold strategy where if it can generate genuine support, and, you know, there's evidence in Russia now with, you know, some of the list experiments that people are doing, that there is genuinely majority support for the war, that there is buy-in to this narrative that they're fighting fascists and Nazis in Ukraine. But even if you don't believe that, as long as the propaganda is all-encompassing enough, it's impossible to say otherwise. So it gives the impression of widespread public support, whether that is how people feel individually about the leaders or not.
Well, I guess, you know, in these conditions of particular power dynamics, and power is the title of the conclusion, key term in the title of the book, is of course too, maybe belief or not belief isn't really actually the most relevant or helpful question in that sense, you know, that the kind of, in fact, even wondering what individual people believe is over time might be considered a sort of individualistic Western view or a bourgeois preoccupation. But just to kind of finish then, I mean, as a final question, you've looked over the sort of long durée at lots of these sort of shifts in narratives. And given what you've said about the sheer kind of power and monotony, if you like, or homogeneity of these historical narratives as they are now kind of increasingly enforced, or as enforced as ever in the North Korean case, perhaps. Do you see this as just the latest sort of turn in a sort of, or latest swing in a pendulum process of openness and restriction? Because those broad dynamics are at play, at least in Russia and China. And what's your sense of how, what kind of prospects might there be in future for people who've been educated under such a sort of historical regime to think about things in a different way, should, you know, the political environment change in any of these places, based on previous examples of changes occurring, you know, back into the 20th century and the late 20th, early 21st centuries?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly possible that these stories could change. I think if a fundamentally different regime came to power and allowed a more critical analysis of these stories, certainly they would not be the sort of very glorious triumphalist and sort of all-consuming narratives that they are currently. I think the problem is that new leaders will have the same problem these leaders have had of, well, what do you base your claim to power on? And perhaps, you know, if that's a you know, let's suspend disbelief and say that Navalny comes to power in Russia, you know, perhaps the founding myth becomes about defeating Putinism and he has his own liberal democratic founding myth, although I think probably would be quite skeptical of what the reality would be. You know, it's possible to change the story, and it's possible to, you know, Ukraine's national story is being rewritten in real time as we speak. You know, the founding myth of the Ukrainian identity for the coming generations is now going to be built on its resistance to Russia. So these stories can change, but I think the more likely scenario is that whoever comes next will similarly look out over the course of recent history, look at the options and decide that the wartime narrative, you know, perhaps you want to change aspects of the story and emphasize different elements, but the wartime narrative and the ability to appeal to nationalism is the main insurance policy for whoever comes next. You know, if you have access to extraordinary economic growth and you can point to great, you know, a sudden influx of prosperity and opportunity for your citizens, you can absolutely make that an important part of your national story. But, you know, as we're also seeing here in the West, when the economic times get harder, when growth isn't assured, when people aren't certain about the future, delving back into the past and these glorious stories of the past, and if needed, you know, the idea that there are enemies once again at the gates and the country needs to circle around the leaders and stand up to these threats, you know, those are the real potent narratives that I think, you know, what one consistent feature of the book is that, you know, time and again, that's the lever that leaders have reached for is the past and how the past can shape and cement their current claims to power. So the stories can change, but I think we should be prepared for these stories to be a key part of the national narratives of these countries for, you know, for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, well, I don't know whether that's an optimistic prognostication or not, but at the very least, as you say, they encourage anyone in any other setting outside these places to reflect on how some of these kinds of processes are far from alien within our own societies too. But anyway, Katie, optimistic or otherwise, thank you so much for appearing on the podcast today. It was great speaking to you.
Thank you. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Before you go, I guess I'll just ask what you're working on currently. Do you have other writing projects on the go? What's following up from this excellent book?
I'm thinking through a few sort of bigger ideas. My primary focus right now is I joined the New Statesman magazine in January of this year, a publication I've long admired. So I'm focused on a daily basis right now on writing for the New Statesman and really focusing on China, but also on Russia and the war in Ukraine. So there's plenty to write about. But it really does. I feel like we are at an important point in history, and perhaps people always feel like this. But I think some of the issues that, you know, I know you also look at in terms of how the world is shaping up and these battles of ideas between autocracies and democracies, you know, there are really key issues now at stake. And I think focusing on China and Russia and North Korea too, you know, the the certainty that we have perhaps nurtured here in the West about the future of liberal democracy. You know, that's not how a lot of the world sees the present and the future. So there's plenty to write about and look into more detail.
Certainly. Well, I'm sure listeners would do well to look at your other outputs as well, journalistic and written in other venues too. So I would encourage them to do that. Thanks once again, Katie. And thank you, listeners, too, for listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. It's a podcast channel on the New Books Network, and it will be back with you again very soon. Goodbye.